This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Success leaves clues. And if you can grow your economy and reduce your greenhouse gas emissions and become more sustainable, not just in terms of Mother Nature, but from a market perspective, then I think we're going to build more fans and supporters and get more people to become converts. And I think there's hope, despite the pessimism of the moment. And I really do. I'm not just saying that naively. I'm saying that based on his history. And history is not kind to idlers. So let us not be idle, but to those that are resilient and can adapt, history is very favorable. And the environmental issue is all about adaptability. It's all about resilience. And if we're flexible and resilient, we'll thrive.
This being primary election week in California and seven other states, we thought it an appropriate time to revisit our discussion with California gubernatorial candidate Gavin Newsom. In our discussion, which was on the heels of the election of Donald Trump in late 2016, Newsom delved into a number of important environmental policy issues, ranging from California's clean energy plan, to the Delta Tunnels project, to the future of nuclear energy in the state. These issues are just as relevant as ever, and Newsom's optimism is a salve for what the past year has wrought. Listen now to this California candidate, who's known nationally as a pioneer in gay rights, a champion for the environment, and a consistently progressive Democrat. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the Lieutenant Governor of California and the former Mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom. Gavin, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, obviously, we need the whole world to fight climate change, and the whole country must participate, not just California. But let's focus on some of the strides California's made. There have been some pioneering policies, and they've gotten even more aggressive with SB 32 that Governor Brown recently signed. But emissions have fallen more slowly in the state than the rest of the nation. There's debate on why that is. But with these good policies in place, why are we still lagging in terms of emissions?
Well, if we look at a broader trend, there's no state that has been, I think, more sustainable in terms of its footprint than California on a per capita basis, especially as it relates to electricity use and the like. California's energy efficiency programs have been a model of the country. We've made great progress. We've had some audacious goals in terms of reducing our greenhouse gases. We have a renewable portfolio standard that's second to none that we've actually achieved 25% baseline. We have a goal now of getting to 50% by 2030. We have audacious goals to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. And I'm confident we can achieve those goals. So there may be momentary or setbacks, or maybe situational setbacks. I'll give you an example of why. We had a nuclear power plant that we shut down precipitously here in the state. And as a consequence of shutting it down so quickly, we actually had to procure a lot of greenhouse gas producing natural gas.
You're talking about Santa Onofre.
Santa Onofre, which all of a sudden then we saw, as we shut that down, we saw a commensurate increase in some of our emissions. That will ultimately begin to level out. We're not going to make the same mistake with our other nuclear power plant, which I was involved with negotiating a closure of. We're going to actually have a bridge there and make sure that bridge is not a ditch with natural gas, but a bridge to the future with wind and energy efficiency. And we have the time to do that, to level it out. We've been putting, as you know, some of the largest scale wind projects in the world, not just the nation. Kern County and Riverside counties in California have the largest solar installations in the world. So we're doing it at scale. We're also doing it in a distributed manner with rooftop solar and a lot of our incentives. We've been very aggressive on energy efficiency, but again, we want to do more on that. We have some audacious goals to double our energy efficiency programs in the state in the next decade plus. So, you know, there may be some momentary setbacks, but I think we're on a very positive trajectory. And long-windedly, let me make one final point. We've grown our economy throughout. You know, our audacious goals in the last 4 or 5 years have also mirrored a very robust economic recovery that's second to no other state in the nation. We've actually performed even Texas in the last few years in terms of job creation. And I say that only because we have this interesting competition with the state of Texas. So we're proving the and, not the or, that you can reduce your greenhouse gas emissions and grow your economy. And we're now doubling down, quite literally, not just figuratively, doubling down on these audacious goals into the future. And I think that's a very healthy thing for our economy.
You mentioned the other nuclear plant, Diablo Canyon. San Onofre, as you mentioned, has relied upon natural gas as a quote-unquote bridge fuel to the renewable future that everybody was hoping for or is hoping for when they close a relatively clean alternative like nuclear.
Yep.
Vermont had a very similar experience with the Vermont Yankee power plant that got closed down. Now Vermont is buying a decent amount of power from Massachusetts's nuclear plant. The problem with trying to overcome that shortfall just with wind is that wind has to be overhauled every 20 years. Where do you see the technical innovations that are going to allow us to reach these pretty audacious goals? I mean, they should be commended, but a lot of people see nuclear as by far a lesser of two evils when we're talking about fossil fuels, and we're still using a lot of fossil fuels in this state.
Nuclear is no longer now part of California's future. Should it be part of the discussion and dialogue as it relates to other nations' low-carbon green growth strategies? I think the answer is self-evident, absolutely. To the extent that we debated the fate of the last nuclear power plant, its future was debated in the context of a number of things. One was, yes, our ability to deliver on the promise of alternatives that could achieve our same audacious greenhouse gas goal reductions, but also on the basis that we actually put this plant in one of the most dangerous seismic areas in the state, and that folks in a post-Fukushima world didn't want to roll the dice. You just saw, you know, internationally in the last week, we saw a massive earthquake in New Zealand, another major earthquake off the coast in Japan. California is long overdue. We're literally talking right now near three large faults, two of which are over 100 years since they've gone off, the San Andreas and the Hayward faults. It's almost a statistical anomaly that we're going to have a major seismic event in this state. And so there's a lot of concern and a lot of consideration about that plant and where it was sited. But I have every confidence. Look, policy is an accelerator. We don't know what we don't know as it relates to technology. I think we're entering into an acceleration phase as it relates to Moore's Law, not just Moore's Law, but in terms of Mother Nature. And that requires some, you know, ingenuity. It requires kind of investment that we've seen in the past. None of us could have imagined solar cost to decrease the extent that they have. I mean, a lot of folks promoted that, but it's real. It's now competitive. Wind, we've got to deal with storage issues. Storage is the next great bastion of opportunity from an innovation perspective. But I have every confidence that we'll be able to achieve these goals. And again, the low-hanging fruit in all this is energy efficiency, which I think we barely scratched the surface. So we promoted and promised, once that last nuclear plant is shut down, that we would actually reach a portfolio of 55%, not just 50%, a portfolio of green electricity. And PG&E, one of the largest utilities in the United States, doubled down and supported that. And I think it said a lot that PG&E believed that nuclear, they don't need that baseload energy, that they will rely on more flexible distributed energy sources that they feel can achieve the same result at a competitive price. I think that's a very positive thing.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom. The Delta Tunnels project is one that has been bandied about, and it's very controversial. First, could you maybe explain for our listeners around the country what the Delta Tunnels project is?
Yeah, so the Delta is the area that number of years ago was identified as one of the three most vulnerable areas in the United States of America.
The Sacramento Delta.
Sacramento Delta. This is the area sort of feeding from Sacramento, the state capital, into the San Francisco Bay. It's one of the world's great estuaries. It's one of the most dynamic environmental areas, but it's also the source of so much of the water for not just the region, but for the state more broadly. And it's been part of a long history of debate about access and availability of water. There was a proposal back when Jerry Brown was first governor in the 70s for a peripheral canal that in essence would take more of Northern California's water and ship it down to the south and Central Valley and the southern part of the state. So it's really divided the state north-south. It's more complicated than that, but that's how it's been more broadly defined. The goal for the current administration now, Governor Brown in his fourth term, is to develop two large tunnels and invest roughly $15 billion, plus or minus, to take tunnels and to hit water and in a more reliable way, pump those waters. And by the way, these are tunnels that are about the size of the Channel between France and England. That
30,
gives you a sense.
40 feet high,
they're
right?
Massive tunnels, massive public works project. This is not small pipes.
And the costs are
$15 billion. It was originally $25.
And some say it could be $80 billion.
And exactly. Anytime you hear anyone estimate the costs, probably double it to begin with. That's sort of, you know, tongue in cheek, but fair point. $15 billion is the sticker price advertised. And the idea is to create more reliability, to address endangered species, the Delta smelt, Chinook salmon, to address salinity issues as it relates to the Delta, to upgrade some of the Delta levees around earthquake concerns and considerations, and to provide more resource, or at least more predictability of water resource in the central part of the state, not just the southern part of the state, though both are beneficiaries. That's all been challenged, not just by the issues that I think will present themselves with the Trump administration, but also around issues of cost. And third, the concern now that the payers, the rate payers, this is a revenue bond, rate payers would pay for the cost of construction. It's not a general obligation.
And that's where those costs could get higher.
And the costs could get higher. So people say, all right, if I'm going to pay for it, which are not the folks necessarily in the Bay Area and Northern California, it's folks in the Central Valley and southern part of the state. They're saying, well, if we're going to pay for it, thank you. We believe there may be more reliability, but we actually now want more water. We don't just want more reliability because we're going to pay this price. We want more of it. And the more of it is, you know, fighting words. And that's where the coalition is beginning to fray a little bit. The Valley, I go in the Central Valley, and frankly, folks are mixed down there. It's not unanimous, they're for it. And they're not necessarily against it, but they want a little bit more assurance that we're gonna get more water. And the folks in the southern part of the state are saying, you know what, this 4 years of drought, entering a fifth year, has forced us to think anew about water policy and to become more autonomous, more independent, focus on water recycling, focus on toilet tap strategies, focus on groundwater replenishment, focus on efficiency, focus on stormwater capture, focus on basically becoming more autonomous, even with desal in Carlsbad, the largest desal facility, Western Hemisphere, just opened in San Diego
County.
Which
we always
area.
Hear that's so expensive, desalination, but this Delta Tunnels project may be
challenged with it. All of this has sort of muddied the proverbial waters on this. That said, the governor was successful in defeating an initiative that would have killed the tunnels and is now has a green light to politically, quote unquote, figure this thing out. And I think the question will be called in the next year. If he does not succeed with the tunnels, the problem doesn't go away. The Delta remains an outstanding concern and issue. You can't just keep the conditions the way they are.
Is it fair to say that they're throwing out their dream scenario for something, that this is a big engineering vision and it can be scaled back or transmogrified into something
Privately,
that will be a little more practical?
Yeah, privately, the governor's office has been messaging that, and it's not so private, so I can share it. But originally, it was a $25 billion project. It's now down to $15 billion, which suggests they've already made some modifications. Most of that was on environmental, not necessarily on the large-scale construction and the tunnels themselves. But I can assure you there are subsequent compromises that are anticipated and proposals that will be made public very shortly that will ultimately reinforce your observation and your question. This is not the proposal. That's the final proposal, put it that way.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom. One of the philosophical differences I saw throughout this campaign that I think had a lot of us shaking our heads was being able to promise the moon, but not ask for any sacrifice. You read any article about California's clean energy proposals and will it lead to higher electricity costs? Will it lead to higher gas prices? Or let's flip that over to water usage. You drive down Highway 5, you're going to see, thanks, Nancy Pelosi, somebody's blaming somebody for not getting that water, however rational or irrational it may be.
Yeah, right.
High-speed rail.
Right.
There's a lot of not in my backyard, NIMBYism. Like, there's not a lot of sacrifice. How does a politician like yourself call it like it is and ask an electorate that's been fed for the last 40 years endless tax cuts with endless growth as this kind of magical thinking? How do we get past that? Because we need more than magical thinking to really make these changes.
No, I think, well, this is going to be the challenge of the Trump administration, right, is to follow through on everything they promoted and somehow suggest they go back to a world that no longer exists, and they're going to have abundant coal operations, and they're going to bring back manufacturing and actual jobs associated with that manufacturing. And most objective observers sort of laugh at the prospect of that because they recognize the tech genie's out of the bottle, coal itself has been under threat because of natural gas. Coal's fate and future is very limited here in the United States, and the manufacturing world is being substantially automated and maybe coming back and onshoring, but the reality is not coming back with the same number of jobs by any stretch of the imagination. So yeah, you have to be honest with folks, but you don't have to be sort of dystopian about it. I think you can have an optimistic and honest conversation about not necessarily sacrifices, but trade-offs and the transition and paint a bright future. People want at least a sense of optimism about their future. And even if it requires some white water of change to go from something old to something new, at least we have to paint the vibrancy of the future. And when it comes to the environment, I don't see it as a massive sacrifice. I really don't. It's kind of, for me, like the Olympics. Even if you don't make it on the team, you're going to be a lot healthier. Meaning, even if you don't actually achieve your goals, the economy is going to be healthier because we're going to be, by definition, more efficient. We'll have a more sustainable mindset, less situational. It will force innovation. It will force behavioral change that ultimately, I think, will inure more favorably long term. So even if there's some short term friction in terms of that change, I don't see it as the kind of trade-off that some suggest. I think we've proven, again, the tyranny of or can be replaced with the genius of and, that you can do certain things and, as you change behavior and animate better behavior, and actually produce more positive outcomes. My point is this. Per unit, the cost of energy may be higher in California, but because of our energy efficiency, your bill actually can be a little bit lower. That we can transition from dirty fuels, and as we transition, create real jobs and opportunity with large-scale solar plants and solar thermal and geothermal strategies and rooftop solar, and actually paint a brighter picture. And so I've seen the argument for sacrifice, but I think when it comes to environmental sustainability, environmental stewardship, I'm not I'm not convinced that we have to be so pessimistic about those trade-offs.
I think public transportation is really an opportunity to make people see things in a different way than they do now. I forget the percentage, but a very low percentage, surprising low percentage of Americans have a passport. They don't.
Yeah,
but when I lived in Japan for 4 years, and you look in the ads for apartments, every little thing has how many minute walk to a train station. That boosts the value of your place significantly.
Yeah,
if you're 2 minutes away from a major train station, you can get from A to B in this labyrinth of a city very quickly. And what's encouraging is that the younger generation, they prefer to have a cell phone over a driver's license. They don't necessarily want a car anymore.
In 15 years, some people will have driver's licenses and they'll pay a huge penalty. I mean, the DMV, as we know it, is dead. I was just in the Uber driverless cars last week going in rush hour here in San Francisco. It's here. The technology exists. In 10, 15 years, it's going to exist at scale. The whole experience of transportation is radically realigning itself. I mean, Ford just announced they're a mobility company. They're recognizing the nature of car sales are going to radically change the likelihood of all of us owning a car or having two or three cars in the family.
Wait, take a step back. You were in the Uber driverless
car? I was literally being driven around by a driverless car last week in rush hour traffic with two engineers in the back seat with the car driving. I was 6 months ago, literally with my son at Sears Point Raceway in Northern California in Sonoma, driving 108 miles an hour on the Sears Point racetrack with no one in the driver's seat, in the back seat with a person in the front passenger seat with a kill switch just in case. I don't believe that future is that far away, and it's going to radically change the relationship we have with our cars. It's going to change our land use policies, our parking ratios as it relates to housing, change the affordability issues related to housing by reducing the cost of housing associated with having garages. It's going to significantly change mobility writ large, and it's going to
trucking.
Have trucking literally about three blocks from where we are doing this interview. Uber has their trucking headquarters where they do their manufacturing here in San Francisco in a warehouse. And they have, I saw four of those large trucks that they've been testing now in Nevada. Their cars are being tested in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, the city. And now they're going to start being tested in other cities across the country. The whole relation, everything about transportation is radically going to change. And again, our kids, my kids, certainly are not going to go to the drivers and go to a DMV that we know today. It will be irrelevant because they're, you know, if you're going to drive, you're going to have higher insurance. If you're going to drive, you're going to pay a penalty for driving because you're more dangerous. You're more likely to create problems in an automated world. And I should note, this is not science fiction. The likelihood we're going to have drones delivering, not packages, but people, in the next 10, 15 years is significant as well. They're already testing drone technology with pods for individuals' transportation. So we're already seeing suborbital flights. You're already seeing nature of cars. Whole issue of transportation, I think, is going to be radically disrupted in the next 10, 15 years. And I think that's ultimately going to be a net positive for the environment.
What did your wife say when you took your child?
My son Hunter. There's a picture of him and me in the car in USA Today. It was a thrill for my son. It was one of the highlights he talks about with everybody. Going 108 miles an hour, quite literally, around this track. And again, that was 6 months ago. And that technology is already exists in the 2017 models that are coming out at Audi. And the driverless technology that Uber's testing, they're one of many folks that are testing, again, is 4 or 5 years out from being readily available in cities large and small. 10 years from now, you'll whistle up like you did a horse in an old black and white Western. You'll have your app, and your car will pick you up, and then your car will find its own parking space. And the reality is you don't necessarily need a car, which means cars are going to radically be redesigned because they'll become, you know, be cars that will be sold like suites in a hotel room, you know, your executive suites, your pods for this or that. I mean, again, this is a future that we will experience. It's a future I've already had the privilege of experiencing in beta, but ultimately will be scaled. Again, you can't have the same conversations we've been having the last 50 years. Technology is about to enter its exponential phase. I mean, it was 10 years ago where Twitter was still a sound, Facebook didn't exist, the cloud was still in the sky, 4G was a parking space, LinkedIn was a prison, big data was a rap star, Skype for most of us was a typo. Those were 10 years ago. And now you're entering this exponential phase where additive manufacturing and smart metals, genomics and synthetic biology, what's happening with artificial intelligence and big data, and the combinatorial nature of technology, I think is going to be truly disruptive. And as a consequence, again, the future of work is going to be, I think, a more challenging topic for conversation for elected officials like myself. But from an environmental framework, I think it's going to radically change the paradigm as it relates to one of our great polluting problems, and that's transportation writ large.
20 years ago, when I got a car in Tokyo, I had to go down to City Hall, and you have to prove that you have a parking space. Yeah. You can't get a car without proving you have a parking, and that's pretty standard in Asia.
Yeah, it won't be the case in the future. Because the parking spaces, there'll just be a different relationship with on-street parking and access. Sidewalks will be redesigned, pedestrian. The land use is going to radically change our thinking. I mean, the idea that we're having, we're doing developments that are supposed to be around for 50 years and we're designing these large parking areas, it completely dismisses the world that we're about to enter into. It's rather preposterous. Planning and zoning is going to radically change in real time. And I don't think people fully appreciate how quickly that reality is going to take shape.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom. Listening to you talk about these important policy issues makes me hopeful. We have been through a lot the last couple of weeks as a nation and shaking our heads. And you said we all have to think locally, and hearing you, somebody who's in a important elected position to make significant change, that you care about this policy in a profound way, should make all of us hopeful. And I want to thank you for that.
I appreciate that. And look, one thing I know is we're resilient, and this nation's resilient, this state's resilient. And I have absolute optimism about our fate and future. I really do. My framework's not scarcity, it's abundance. I really believe that. I think we have limitless capacity, and you got to deal with reality. You can't deny it, and we can then retreat from it, or we can step up, step in, and be bold. And this is California at scale. It's going to lead the world in low carbon green growth strategies. We're going to radically change the way we produce and consume energy. And I believe in federalism. I believe in states' rights. I believe you can punch above your weight. I believe that when I was mayor of San Francisco, that was the greenest, most sustainable city in the greenest and most sustainable state. And I believe ultimately we're going to have an impact beyond our borders here in California, across the rest of the nation and the world. Success leaves clues. And if you can grow your economy and reduce your greenhouse gas emissions and become more sustainable, not just in terms of Mother Nature, but from a market perspective, then I think we're going to build more fans and supporters and get more people to become converts. And I think there's hope, despite the pessimism of the moment. And I really do. I'm not just saying that naively. I'm saying that based on his history. And history is not kind to idlers, so let us not be idle. But to those that are resilient and can adapt, history is very favorable. And the environmental issue is all about adaptability. It's all about resilience. And if we're flexible and resilient, we'll thrive.
He's the Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom. Gavin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Grateful. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by AIM and the Rolling Stones. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast.
Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.